to 17 growth opportunities in parallel. When an M&A opportunity came along in an attractive services business, which would likely have provided that growth pillar, the resources to execute the deal were not available because 16 other managers were drawing on them for their respective initiatives. The deal didn't happen. Corporate peanut butter almost guarantees that you won't make a big enough move to get to the top of the power curve. Shooting for the known. At the other end of the business calendar, when it gets to incentives, bonuses, and promotions, there lies another cause for timid plans. We all want to succeed, of course. But that means that most of us will vastly prefer a P90 plan, one that will hit with a 90% chance, over a P50 plan, which we would hit only 50% of the times we try. In fact, a lot of people we work with would quietly admit they only agree to budget targets that they feel confident they can hit almost for sure, P100, save any completely unexpected disruptions. Yet when we ask CEOs what would be fair in terms of misses, many of them say that every 3 to 4 years a leader should miss a plan if the plan has been stretched enough, i.e., P60 to P75 plans. What a difference in perspective. The head of operations for a large high-tech industrial company, actually the same one we just mentioned, told us recently, "We were beaten up badly earlier this year for missing a target. I'm not going to risk that again. I understand we might get to gold standard performance by the end of the year, but let's first get to the performance level written in the annual plan and then see where we go from there." The problem being that, by that time, any chance of reaching the more ambitious target by the end of the year had passed. With all the timidity baked into us and into the process, even bold plans can't shake the lethargy. Here's the really confounding thing, though. While hockey sticks routinely produce the dreaded hairy backs, real hockey sticks do exist, and those real hockey sticks are how companies typically make major moves upward on the power curve. Look at the power curve. Companies in the top quintile earn 30 times as much as the average company in the middle quintiles. Moving to that top quintile is almost by definition a hockey stick plan that creates enormous value for stakeholders. They do happen, but how? Real hockey sticks. Take a look at Exhibit 9. The gray line is the typical company, one that starts in the middle quintiles and is still there a decade later. The black line started in the same exact place but was one of the companies to make it to the top quintile over the 10-year period. That black line sure looks like a hockey stick, a dip for the first 4 years followed by rapid progress. Satya Nadella is CEO of Microsoft because he produced a real hockey stick. When he was promoted in 2011 to run a business at Microsoft that included its cloud services, the cloud was a small part of his business, which in turn was a modest-sized part of the whole company. But Nadella saw so much potential that he devoted almost all his personal time to the cloud business, along with an outsized proportion of his total resources. The business grew rapidly from revenue in the hundreds of millions to several billions, and Nadella was named CEO in early 2014. When NXP, the former semiconductor division of Philips, was spun out to private equity in 2006, the top team aggressively reallocated investments, given the winner-takes-all nature of the industry. NXP divested large and prestigious areas, such as chips for mobile and digital that consumed huge resources, and made big bets on chips for identification and automotive uses. The hockey stick growth of the chosen markets led to a fivefold increase in market value over the following decade. Real hockey sticks do exist. The issue is separating the few real ones from the many fakes. The conundrum we are facing is that we should doubt every hockey stick, yet we often need one if we're to move up the power curve. So what does it take to actually move on the curve? Chapter 4. What are the odds? Strategy plays out in a world of probabilities, not certainties. But the odds are knowable. 8% of middle-tier companies manage to jump up into the top quintile of the power curve over a decade. But which ones? Once you've recognized the perils of the social side of strategy, you need a new paradigm. Consider poker and golf. In general, the more that skill is involved in a game like golf, the less you need to think about probabilities. If we played a world-class golfer, say the likes of Bernhard Langer or Rory McIlroy, we could be quite sure that we'd never win in a match against them, probably not even on a single hole. The more that luck, uncertainty, is involved in a game like poker, the more you need to ponder the odds. In poker, we'd not only have a chance to win a hand against a world-class player like Phil Hellmuth with his record 14 World Series of Poker bracelets, but would even occasionally beat him in a tournament, as people actually do. Hellmuth would certainly beat us over time, and we are probably well advised not to play him, but in the short run, we'd have a chance. Don't get us wrong, business is obviously a matter of skill, of great skill. You don't just have cards dealt to you, you work hard for the assets and talents that you get to deploy. But there is uncertainty, and strategy is about how to deal with it. In any game, as in business, your goal needs to be to give yourself the best possible odds and to think in those terms. People shouldn't just get credit for winning and demerits for losing. If 5 companies each have an 80% chance of succeeding, that still means that one will usually fail. If 5 companies each have a 20% chance of success, one of the 5 is still likely to win. If all we see from these 10 companies together is 5 wins and 5 fails, it would be wrong to look at all of them the same way. Clearly, the superior strategy is the one with an 80% chance of success, and this is the one that should be given the credit, no matter whether you win or lose. Risk, of course, needs to be part of the probability discussion, too. If you have just a slim chance of winning, but a bet costs you little and the potential to win is huge, that still may be an investment worth making. The converse is true, too. An expensive investment that generates a high probability of a small success may be a bad idea. Poker players refer to the calculations as pot odds. If a $100 bet gives you a 20% chance of winning a $200 pot, you fold. Essentially, you are paying $100 for $40, that 20% of the $200. But a $100 bet that gives you a 20% chance of winning a $2,000 pot is one you make every time, because you're paying $100 to get $400, 20% of $2,000. So an assessment of your odds, competitive, market, regulatory, etc., needs to be part of your calculation. Leicester City's soccer team showed us in the 2015-16 English Premier League season that anything is possible, no matter the odds. The team, in early years sometimes relegated to the third division of the English Premier League, had made an improbable run through the second division and into the first division, but was considered to be such a long shot for the 2015-16 championship that bookmakers said there was a greater chance that Elvis Presley was still alive than that Leicester City would win the Premier League. And then Leicester City won the title. As much fun as that was, many called it the biggest upset in the history of sports, we don't like to bank on being the exception. We always should assume we're going to be the rule. Okay, what are the odds? The knowable probability of success. We ran the numbers and can report that at the highest level, your odds look like those in Exhibit 10. This chart shows the odds of making a move across the quintiles of the power curve over a 10-year period if you started in the middle 3 quintiles. Your odds of going from the middle quintiles of the curve to the top quintile over a 10-year period are 8%. 8%. Let that sink in for a moment. Fewer than 1 in 10 companies make such a gain over a 10-year period. In the strategy room 10 years ago, you can imagine how many companies actually planned for such a performance improvement. Some might even have been convinced that they could pull it off. Probably most had their plans approved. Not even 1 in 10 made it. Wow. Those are tough odds. Another way to show this is in Exhibit 11. The matrix tells you, based on where you started, what the odds are for where you'll end up. You should start getting familiar with that number 8 on the diagram. It's on the end of the middle row, which tells you the odds of ending in the top if you started in the middle. Next, look at the light gray diagonal reading 43, 78, 59, which tells you the odds of ending in the same location where you started. Turns out, the entire curve is rather sticky. It is hard to achieve any mobility at all. 78% of firms in the flat middle stayed put, and pity those 43% of bottom quintile firms that were still stuck there 10 years later. Now look at the top row. Those firms that started at the top. They have a 59% chance of still being in that quintile 10 years later. Nice. But that means you have a 41% chance of moving down the power curve, including a 15% chance of ending up in the bottom quintile. Now, plenty of firms are just going to move within the middle tier. The efforts to continuously sustain and upgrade performance are very important, and companies can deliver great results for shareholders by steadily improving their position on the curve. It's just that, given the extreme non-linearity of the curve, the giant leaps matter exponentially more. The odds of individual business units moving up and down the curve are roughly the same as for companies. And when companies make a big move up the curve, it is mostly because one or at most two of their businesses make a hockey stick improvement. When we looked at 101 companies that moved up at least one quintile and for which we had business unit level data, in 2/3 of the cases, it was just one of the units that moved up. Think about that for a moment. If you have a portfolio of 10 businesses, chances are that only one will make a hockey stick move over a 10-year period. And correctly identifying that one and feeding it all the resources it needs will most likely determine whether the company as a whole can make a significant move up the power curve. This insight about the need to find the 1 in 10 has huge implications for how you run a multi-business company. Having a plan that gives you a chance of moving up the power curve means, first and foremost, that you choose the right businesses in your portfolio to back. Their chances are 1 in 10 to show real improvement, and you probably only have to pick one or two businesses correctly. Flight paths of the upwardly mobile. Just as companies deliver economic profit in very different combinations, remember the discussion we had about Starbucks and Walmart? Movements on the power curve also result from different flight paths, i.e. combinations of ROIC and growth performance over time. When there are big movements up and down the power curve, these flight paths are spectacular. Starting from sea level, an average starting economic profit of $11 million a year in 2000 to 2004 for the middle tier companies, a move to the top generates an extra economic profit of $628 million annually on average, and a whopping 8.9 percentage points in ROIC. That's a gain of almost 1 point a year. Descents are just as crushing as ascents are exhilarating. Companies that went down lost $421 million from their annual economic profit on average and compressed their ROIC by 4.5 percentage points. Some flight paths are more likely to get you to the stars than others. Exhibit 12 shows what happens depending on your performance against the median firm. If you underperform on both growth and ROIC improvement, you have virtually no chance of getting off the ground. In fact, you have a 27% chance of falling from the middle to the bottom quintile. High growth with below-median ROIC improvements gives you a small chance of an upside, but doesn't do much to reduce the downside risk. A performance-only strategy that focuses on improving ROIC but does not deliver above-median growth is certainly playing it safe. You have almost zero chance of going down, but that strategy just gives you sample average odds of going up to the top quintile at 8%. The magic happens when both growth and ROIC improvements work in concert. Outperforming on both these levers is rewarded by a much higher chance of upward mobility, 19%. It is this increasing returns to scale dynamic that seems to matter, where each increment of growth makes the business not only bigger, but also better. Assets built around common shareable intellectual property, those with network or platform effects, and those with higher fixed costs enabling massive economics of scale, tend to have increasing returns to scale. What do those data mean for you? Well, if your hockey stick plan does not commit to improvements in both growth and ROIC, you might want to give it some more thought. Getting into the top quintile is harder than you might have expected, and the flight paths to the top underscore this challenge. A Tale of Three Companies. A look at three companies will help us illustrate the different flight paths that companies can take, as shown in Exhibit 13. PCC is a U.S.-based maker of precision aircraft components, incidentally owned by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway for the last few years. UNFI is an American distributor of natural organic and specialty foods and related products. DNP is a leading Japanese newspaper publisher. We picked these three because they started the period 2000 to 04 as next-door neighbors right in the middle of the power curve. Their outcomes could not have been more different, with PCC sailing up, UNFI staying fixed, and DNP sliding down. PCC pulled off a real hockey stick and went straight to the top quintile, generating a 27% CAGR, compound annual growth rate, in total shareholder return. They did this by making four big moves to double down in an industry with a strong tailwind, aerospace and defense. UNFI stayed in the middle of the curve, focusing on making productivity gains to offset the impact of adverse industry trends. DNP dropped to the bottom quintile because it chose to invest heavily via both CapEx and M&A in an industry with strong headwinds. Remember that printing was starting to be affected by digital media during that period. There are many angles to why all of that happened, and we will revisit some of them later. But we can be close to certain that in 2001, in each of their strategy rooms, their leaders were plotting for a move to the top. They were approving hockey stick plans. They were in good company. Across the power curve, everybody is under performance pressure, everybody has high hopes, and everybody is working incredibly hard for a better future. But as in the case of PCC, UNFI, and DNP, not everybody will see their dreams come true. More important, not everybody has the same chance of getting there. In fact, quite the opposite is true. Take a look at Exhibit 14. We are admittedly jumping ahead a bit, but take our word for the moment. Imagine you had a model that converted measurable attributes about a company into adjusted or conditional odds about how likely they were to succeed. Well, we do. Even though the average is 8%, it turns out that the chances of companies in the middle of making it to the top quintile are not only different, they are vastly different based on our model outputs. Just as the fates of our three companies were very different, so too were their starting odds, and they played out those odds. This is intriguing, isn't it? While the odds, on average, are just 8%, the odds for individual companies range from nearly 0% all the way to more than 80%. If the chances of making it to the top turn out to be so different for each of the companies on the power curve, then the question for CEOs, managers, and investors, of course, is, can those odds only be calculated after the fact, or could they have been known beforehand? We will explore this question for much of the rest of the book, and what business leaders can do about changing these odds. But let's start with a simple question. Why are the odds of success not in the strategy room when plans are being discussed? Where are the odds in the strategy room? Conversations in the strategy room tend to be like those at a consumer goods client of ours with $18 billion in revenue and the aspiration of achieving double-digit growth. The company did a great deal of planning, and the aspiration looked reasonable. But the company's actual odds of success hadn't yet made it into the room. The plan was built based on an inside view, building from the bottom-up estimates of the business units. A straightforward bit of research made the company reconsider. Publicly available information showed that among industry peers within the same revenue range as our client, only 10% generated sustained double-digit growth over 10 years. The question became, is our strategy actually better than 90% of our peers? Really? What makes us stand out, even though we'd performed like an average company over the prior 5 years, growing in the mid-single digits? To tell you the truth, bringing the actual odds into the strategy room did not make us very popular with the management team, but they did recalibrate the conversation in important ways. An executive told us, "We had no idea that our value creation plans were so concentrated on so few areas." While the statistics of moving on the power curve are straightforward enough, those odds are rarely discussed in the strategy room. Companies in the top quintile tend to think that's where they belong. After all, they worked hard to get there and have developed impressive advantages over the competition. Why wouldn't they stay at the top of the heap? Likewise, companies in the middle quintiles tend to believe that they can move up. A chance that they'll drop to the bottom quintile? Why bother to even consider that possibility? We collectively have seen hundreds of strategic plans and can observe that the frequency of a plan for a company at the top of the curve to show a slide down is much lower than the real statistics we assembled for this book. Some plans do suggest a slide down, but not nearly the approximately 40% we observe in the real life of companies. With odds comes the explicit realization of risks, and loss aversion kicks in. Directly confronting risks can make people gun-shy, even when we're actually interested in having them take more risks. That can be a problem. The push for certainty. In strategy rooms, there often seems to be a push towards certainty, not odds. The work usually begins by entertaining lots of ideas and then testing them to winnow them down. Once there are some clear hypotheses, they are tested and refined with the idea of reducing uncertainty. While we don't always succeed, as those hairy backs show, we certainly attempt to do so. Forcing us to think in terms of probabilities works against that desire for certainty, that consensus that lets us all leave the room united on the plan and ready to execute. As one CEO in Italy told us, "I can't handle multiple realities." Pushed to consider various possible future scenarios, he said, "I'd rather pick the world I live in. It's much easier to tell people, you do this, you do that, than to live in a world of probabilistic uncertainty. With probabilities in the room, KPIs become harder to specify. Spreadsheets aren't exactly built for odds and ranges either. They're built for specific numbers, so it's hard to start dealing with a 75% chance that a value will be between X and Y, multiplied by the thousands of cells in a corporate budget. U.S. President Harry Truman famously said he wanted a one-handed economist so he would no longer have to listen to his experts say, on the one hand this, on the other hand that. You might have heard similar sentiments in your strategy room as people tried to bring discussions to a close. Life is not a scenario. Make up your mind. Go left or right, but make a decision. Probabilities? I don't care what you do in your office, but when you come up here and present, tell us what you think. Issues of favoritism kick in, too, that don't fit well with odds. As soon as we decide not to peanut butter resources and instead back business units that have the best prospects, then we're not only picking winners, we're also picking losers. But nobody likes to lose. We all know how hard people will then fight to protect their resources, and we are all prone to protect people who are our friends, or loyal, or both. Bringing probabilities in can make evaluating performance uncomfortably complex. The situation resembles the FBI office that hears about a gang that intends to rob one of three banks. The head of the office dispatches teams to all three banks to catch the thieves. Obviously, only one team will capture the gang, but the entire unit should receive the praise and rewards. But we know that most of the time, the ones who are in the right place at the right time will be lauded as heroes and rewarded. You are your numbers. Bill Parcells, an American football coach, illustrated this well by saying, "We are what our record says we are." In other words, quit claiming moral victories, whining about injuries, and reassuring fans that we'll get better. Even if you get your management team to think in terms of probabilities, those probabilities might be forgotten at the end of the year when it comes to performance evaluations. Either you made your numbers, or you didn't. Ed Catmull at Pixar was very deliberate about how to allow for noble failures. He labeled some projects as being experimental, not aimed at theatrical release, to encourage people to try riskier ideas. He also funded some ideas considered to be unlikely, so failure did not become a stigma. But he still acknowledges that we have to try extra hard to make it safe to fail. If you are going to use odds, you also have to be able to calibrate them precisely, a hard task. Heads of business units will want to get to a P90 plan, one where they have a 90% chance of succeeding, while having the CEO see the plan as P50. The result is often an unspoken compromise. Stretch targets are set, but with baseline budgets, and the first level of incentive pay kicks in if the baseline goals are met. In other words, the CEO gets her stretch goals, but the executive team also gets softer goals that they expect to meet almost all the time. The problem is that the company might end up not pushing initiatives with the right level of ambition, and consequently, not resourcing them appropriately to make a meaningful move up the power curve. The CEO needs to know what the odds really are to be able to calibrate goals and compensation appropriately. It's not only hard to set the right goals at the start of the year, but difficult to sort out causality at the end of the year because of the dust that gets kicked up behind you, making the road traveled hard to see in the rearview mirror. Did success come because of managerial decisions and great execution, or because of an error by a competitor and a favorable market? Did problems occur because bad weather killed demand during the key buying season, or because managers misjudged their customers? We know how the managers would vote on both questions. A prominent example of where a board got it right was when they appointed Wendell Weeks to be the CEO of Corning Glass in 2005. The board did so even though Weeks led the company's optical fiber business, which in the dot-com crash of 2001 had taken Corning almost to the brink. That problem was accurately attributed to the worsening market conditions, not management performance. In subsequent years, Weeks became one of the most highly regarded corporate leaders in America, leading Corning to be number one globally in LCD glass and, with the help of Gorilla Technology, number one in smartphone cover glass as well. Judge from your own experience, but it strikes us that the clear judgment of Corning's board might be more the exception than the rule in terms of boards and CEOs accurately attributing performance. So, where are we now? We have now given you, for the first time, a glimpse at the probabilities of strategy, the odds that a company will move up or down on the power curve, and the notion that the probabilities for individual companies vastly diverge. We've also seen that dealing with probabilities is a challenge for business leaders, but that not properly dealing with them is one of the reasons that social games are being played. Now that the average probabilities of moving on the power curve have entered the room, the obvious next questions are, what is your own company's probability of success, and what actions can you take to improve that probability? How do you change your odds of beating the market? We tell clients that a plan that has a realistic chance of producing a real hockey stick that will carry a company from the middle to the top of the power curve should have an element of magic to it, something that stands out. Jokingly, we say, you should be able to smell the specialness through a video conference if you want to have some confidence that a hockey stick plan is the real deal. In the next chapter, we'll start to go into detail about how to find one. Chapter 5. How to Find the Real Hockey Stick. You can shift the odds of strategy by capitalizing on your endowment, riding the right trends, and most important, making a few big moves. For decades, there has been no shortage of advice on how to develop a successful strategy. Yet we still appear to be wrestling with the same issues. How do we tell good strategy from bad? How do we bring the team along? How do we get significant strategic moves executed? One of our former managing directors wrote a paper about inertia and the lack of agility in organizations to execute resource reallocations in 1973. Why is it that we are still wrestling with the very same conundrums? What's different this time? Almost all strategy books that fill your shelves today suffer from a lack of testable hypotheses. How are we supposed to learn whether a recommendation works if the only supporting evidence is anecdotal or based on case examples? There just isn't any way to quantify and test those ideas, which is why lists of great companies fall apart so quickly. If you look at the three books that sit on more managers' bookshelves than any others, In Search of Excellence, 1982, Built to Last, 1994, and Good to Great, 2001, they use a common method for learning lessons about strategy. They collect companies that are great, excellent, or enduring, and attempt to infer the formula behind that greatness, excellence, and endurance. The assumption is that, by mimicking the company's practices, you will be able to mimic their performance. These are certainly good books. More than 10 million readers can't be wrong. And all the companies highlighted in them were truly incredible. However, look at how the 50 companies mentioned performed over the following decades. If you constructed a portfolio of the stocks on the dates of publication and held them, you would have outperformed the market index by 1.7%. Not bad at all. Good to Great is in the lead at 2.6%, followed by Built to Last at 1.6%, and In Search of Excellence at 1.5%. But the odds that one of these 50 exemplars outperformed the market were just 52%, hardly better than a coin toss, and the chances of a major underperformance were much greater than for a major outperformance. Just 8 companies beat the index by more than 5%, while a total of 16 trailed the index by more than 5%. The prescriptions in these books made sense, but they were somewhat vague, or too specific to an individual company, and it's hard to sort out the winning ideas from the less important ones. Good to Great, for instance, says it's crucial for the CEO to be a level 5 leader. One of the criteria for being a level 5 leader is that the leader pick a successor who is also a level 5 leader. Jack Welch, long regarded as one of the best, made an excellent choice when he named Jeff Immelt to succeed him as CEO at GE in 2000. Unfortunately, GE had essentially become a finance company under Welch, which left it highly vulnerable in the global financial crisis of 2008. Although Immelt restructured GE and divested risk-prone parts of the business, GE shares underperformed the market during Immelt's 16-year tenure. A truly recognized level 5 leader picked another truly recognized level 5 leader, but the company still underperformed. Circumstances, in this case a financial crisis, can overwhelm even world-class level 5 leadership. Many ideas about strategy provide a lens for looking at history and understanding why something failed or succeeded. But what really matters is having a way of peering into the future, not the past. knowing the numbers of yesterday's lottery winner doesn't help so much. Check the facts. That's why we emphasize the use of deep, testable data. We have examined many hypotheses based on publicly available data about thousands of companies around the globe. This helped identify those corporate performance levers that really matter. We back-tested the data and were able to verify that our model generates surprisingly accurate predictions about the chances of a strategy leading to success. We have deployed the analysis in our work over the past 4 years with clients across the globe and found that it does indeed lead to better strategy conversations. Unlike the data that go into the standard inside view, our research provides reference data on broad characteristics, draws from large samples, focuses on probability, and is calibrated from the top down, so it provides a bulwark against social distortions. We've explained how the empirics gave us average odds, but now we're moving to estimating company-specific odds based on the company's attributes. The result is a way to calibrate your strategy in a probabilistic world, a score sheet or benchmark for strategies. Equipped with the knowledge of what attributes are most important, we can now predict the quality of a company strategy in advance. Of course, the social side of strategy won't go down without a fight. But keeping score in a different way can help you shift the conversation. The odds that matter. Yours. So far, we've talked about the probability of success as an 8% chance of moving from the middle to the top of the power curve. But unless you're the theoretical average company, the 8% is not very helpful for you. Instead, you'd rather know the odds of your company and your strategy moving up the power curve. Well, we can do this by adding color to the picture. In just the same way that Thomas Bayes helped us understand conditional probability, the more we know about a company, the more precisely we can estimate its odds of success. Here is a simple analogy. If the only thing we know is that a person is a person, then the best estimate for his or her income is the global average, or about $15,000 per year. If we now add information, say that the person is American, our estimate jumps to the average American income per person, or $56,000. If we add the information that he is an American male, 55 years old, the estimate jumps to $64,500. If that guy works in the IT industry, it jumps to $86,000. And if we know the person is Bill Gates, well, it's a lot more than that. The same thing needs to be true in our assessment of the probabilities of corporate success. To unpack this idea, let's consider the same companies from the last chapter that all started at the same point on the power curve. Based on the average odds, they all had an 8% chance of moving to the top quintile. However, their actual destinies could not have been more different. Could they have known this? Actually, yes, they could have. When we modeled these companies, we discovered that Dai Nippon Printing, DNP, had a 69% chance of going down to the bottom quintile, and down it went. UNFI had an 87% chance of staying in the middle, and that's what happened. The model scored Precise Cast Parts as having a 76% chance of rising to the top, and the company did get there indeed. Odds aren't destiny, of course. If four companies have a 76% chance of moving to the promised land, that still means that one of them, on average, won't make it and will be disappointed. There's not much to be done about that. But a 76% chance is very different from an 8% average and should give way to more confidence in support of a strategy. Many companies give themselves only a slim chance of progress, and they're much better off knowing that before they head too far down a dead end. It's also important, if you're the 76%er who failed to win the bet, to know that you did the right thing and to be undeterred from making that kind of strong wager again. Even if you know your overall odds, you need to understand which of your attributes and actions are the most important in determining your chances for success. That knowledge will guide your decisions about where to dedicate your efforts to give your company the best chance of moving up the power curve. The highly entertaining article, How to Make a Hit Film in The Economist beautifully illustrates it's not only possible to know the odds of success, but how it's possible to know what levers to pull to improve those odds. See Exhibit 15. In 1983, William Goldman, a screenwriter, coined the famous saying that in Hollywood, nobody knows anything when it comes to predicting which films will succeed at the box office. To find out how true that remains, we have analyzed the performance of more than 2,000 films with a budget of more than $10 million released in America and Canada since 1995 to see which factors help make a movie a hit. Our analysis suggests a formula that maximizes the chances of packing them in. First, create a child-friendly superhero film with plenty of action and scope for turning it into a franchise. Set your budget at an impressive but not reckless $85 million. Convince a major studio to distribute it on wide release in the summer, when releases earn an average of $15 million more than at other times. Lastly, cast two lead actors with a solid but unspectacular box office history, who are thus not too expensive. With reasonable reviews from critics and the audience alike, your film would make about $125 million at the American box office. But do it for the money, not the plaudits. Such a film would have just a 1 in 500 chance of carrying off an Oscar for Best Picture. Moving from the box office back into your strategy room, what similar set of attributes leads to a good strategy? The 10 variables that make the difference. In our work on the corporate performance data of 2,393 of the largest companies covering 15 years, 127 industry sectors, and 62 countries, we found 10 levers that are the strongest determinants of your odds of success. We looked at 40 variables and found that 10 of them were key. When we back-tested our model against the 2,393 companies for which we had enough information to place them on the power curve, we were 86% accurate in predicting companies' movement on the curve over the course of a decade in terms of whether they would end up in the top, middle, or bottom parts of the power curve. You probably won't be terribly surprised by any of these 10 performance levers. They're all already somewhere on your list of topics. What hasn't been clear until now, after we completed our empirical work, is the importance of these levers and the degree to which you need to act on them to make a real difference. Our research also shows that some things don't matter as much as you might think for generating a move up the power curve. Discarded variables included the amount of past revenue growth and increases or decreases in industry or geographic diversification. This is, as we've promised, not another framework, but we've decided to group these 10 levers for ease of use into three categories: endowment, trends, and moves. Once you get your arms around these, you will be able to understand much better your real chances of success, ahead of time, when you can still do something about your strategy and its execution. Your endowment is what you start with. Trends are the winds that you are sailing which are pushing you along, hitting you in the face, or buffeting you from the side. Moves are what you do. Endowments, trends, and moves are like the primary colors of strategy. Now, we just have to mix them appropriately. We will detail the 10 variables that determine your chances for success. But first, let us explain how they work, because the rest of the book will then be much easier. First, they are all measured relative to other companies in the sample. It's not how smart you are, but how much smarter you are than the other kids taking the test. If they did all their homework, you need to have done that and more. Second, to get a boost, you have to cross an upper threshold, and we will show you where these thresholds are. It is binary, much like the power curve itself. Getting 1 point better doesn't seem to do much. You need to put yourself in another league. Same goes on the downside. Yes, having a bad score can drag you down too, but only if you go below a lower threshold. Okay, now we can start the tour. Endowment. When companies think about their starting point, they often think in terms of their P&L or their market share, but the three variables that matter most in determining your endowment are your starting revenue, size, your debt level, leverage, and your past investment in R&D, innovation. 1. Size of your company. The larger your company is, the more likely you are to be able to improve your position on the power curve. That may seem to be unfamiliar to smaller companies, or to contradict the success stories we read about startups, but when it comes to scaling the power curve, size amplifies the effects of performance improvement in absolute terms. Our research found that to have a significant advantage on this variable, you need to be in the top quintile in total revenue. Today, that means roughly exceeding $7.5 billion in revenue. No harm if you are not at that level yet. It's just that you won't get an advantage from scale in terms of your chance of moving up on the power curve for now. To illustrate how fast that bar is moving, 10 years ago, $3.3 billion in revenue was big enough to get you into the top quintile for size. 2. Debt level. There is an inverse relationship between how much leverage you have built into your current balance sheet and your chances of moving up the power curve. The less debt you have, the better your chances of moving up. Your debt capacity indicates how much headroom you have available to invest in your growth opportunities. The key here is to have a debt-to-equity ratio that is favorable enough to put you in the top 40% in your own industry. 3. Past investment in R&D. This indicates what prospects you've invested in and what you may have to invest in. You needed to be in the top half of your industry in your ratio of R&D to sales to benefit from a significant improvement in the chances of moving up the power curve. For many questioning their R&D organizations about the return on their investments, it might be a source of comfort to see that R&D investments can pay off. Trends. The two key variables that fall under trends are industry trend and exposure to growth geographies. If your industry is moving up the industry power curve, you're likely to move along with that tailwind. If you're operating in growth geographies, you'll benefit too, though being in the right countries doesn't matter quite as much as being in an industry that trends upward. 1. Industry trend. The trend in your industry is the single most important of all 10 attributes. For your industry to be your friend, it needs to be moving up the industry power curve by at least one quintile over a 10-year period. The metric we used is average growth in economic profit across all companies in the industry. This is like the tide going in or out and lifting or lowering the average level of boats in the harbor. 2. Geographic trend. The key here is to be in markets that are among the top 40% for nominal GDP growth. For companies operating in more than one geographic market, most companies among the 2,393 in the database do, you calculate your corporate-wide GDP growth figure based on the percentage of revenue you received from each geographic market. It's intuitively clear that being exposed to faster-growing markets yields benefits, but equally interesting how overall macroeconomic conditions are a footnote in many long-term strategy discussions. Moves. Many plans based on hockey sticks call for revenue growth equal to GDP and for, say, an increase in margin of 2 percentage points. That sort of approach could in fact let you jump from the middle quintiles of the power curve to the top in 10 years. But remember, only a small percentage of hockey stick projections actually happen. Other companies pursue similar strategies, and the market competes away the improvements through lower prices or more service. Customers benefit, but you just wind up with a hairy back. Our research found 5 moves that, pursued persistently, can get you to where you want to go. They work best in combination, but we'll get into that later. For now, here are the 5 moves we found that matter. 1. Programmatic M&A. This one surprises people because they have the idea that studies show that M&A deals fail, factually wrong, and resist, rightly, the idea of a bet-the-company deal. A key indicator of success is programmatic M&A. A steady stream of deals, each costing no more than 30% of your market cap, but adding up over 10 years to at least 30% of your market cap. 2. Dynamic allocation of resources. Our research found that companies are more likely to succeed when they reallocate capital expenditures at a healthy clip, feeding the units that could break out and produce a major move up the power curve while starving those that are unlikely to surge. The threshold here is reallocating at least 50% of capital expenditure among business units over a decade. 3. Strong capital expenditure. You meet the bar on this lever if you are in the top 20% in your industry in your ratio of capital spending to sales. That typically means spending 1.7 times the industry median. That is a big number. 4. Strength of productivity program. Everybody is trying to reduce their costs, cutting overhead and improving labor productivity. The question is whether you are improving productivity consistently faster than your competitors. Our research found that the bar is at an improvement rate that's at least in the top 30% of your industry. 5. Improvements in differentiation. To make business model innovation and pricing advantages improve your chances of moving up the power curve, you need to make it into the top 30% in your industry in terms of gross margin. This measure captures whether a company has been able to either develop a sustainable cost advantage or charge premium prices because of product differentiation and innovation. It all matters. Exhibit 16 summarizes these 10 levers for companies starting in the middle quintiles. The variables are the same, but the values are a little different if you start in the bottom or the top. One way of seeing the relative importance of the levers is to look at how the odds of upward movement change in different threshold regions for each variable. For example, if your company catches an industry megatrend, your industry moves up at least one quintile on the industry power curve over 10 years, then your company's chances of moving from the middle to the top are 24%. Alas, only the best positioned 20% of companies get to enjoy that much tailwind. But if you have a strong headwind, like 50% of the companies in the sample, the chances of upward movement are just 4%. The other 30% of companies with a moderate industry trend had a 10% chance of moving up. And we compare all these to the overall odds of 8% for all middle-tier companies. If all that seems too complex or boring, the punchline is, the more you can be on the right-hand side of the distribution for the 10 variables, the better your odds. And the more you are on the left-hand side, the worse your odds. The model we developed for this book is a little more complex than that because of different weightings and interactions between variables, but not that much more complex. Are you above the threshold, boosting your odds, or below the threshold, lowering them? Don't be discouraged. In our sample, 60% of companies in the middle three quintiles reached our threshold on only two or fewer of the 10 levers. Note, the impact of these levers on your probability of moving on the power curve depends on your starting point. If your company is at the top or bottom of the power curve, these statistics look very different, and the approach to strategy needs to be tailored. Please refer to the appendix for a detailed description. The Mobility Dashboard. Here is what a mobility dashboard looks like for PCC, the company from Chapter 4 that leaped up the power curve, Exhibit 17. The circles show which percentile PCC was in for each of the 10 variables. The colors on the bars indicate at what point the score on a single lever starts to change the chances of a company moving up or down the power curve, where the thresholds are. If a company scores in the upper shaded zone, the chances of moving up improve. If a company scores in the lower shaded zone of a lever, then there is an odds penalty. As you can see, in 2004, the endowment scores were unimpressive for PCC, a 60-year-old manufacturer of complex metal components and products for the aerospace, power, and industrial markets. Revenue and debt levels were in the middle of the pack, and the company had not invested heavily in R&D. In terms of trends, the geographic exposure was unimpressive. However, the aerospace industry experienced enormous tailwinds over those 10 years, which helped a lot. Most important, though, PCC made big moves that collectively shifted its odds of reaching the top quintile to 76%. The company did so by surpassing the high-performance thresholds on 4 of the 5 moves. For mergers, acquisitions, and divestments, PCC combined a high value and volume of deals over the decade through a deliberate and regular program of transactions in the aerospace and power markets. This was a steady diet of transactions, not one-off binges. The last 2 years of our study were typical of PCC's actions through the decade. In 2013, PCC acquired Permaswage SAS, a manufacturer of aerospace fluid fittings, for $600 million and divested its Primus Composites business. This was followed by the acquisition of Aerospace Dynamics, an operator of high-speed machining centers, for $625 million in 2014, or roughly 2% of PCC's market capitalization. In other moves, PCC reallocated 61% of its capital spending among its three major divisions, while managing the rare double feat of both productivity and margin moves, the only aerospace and defense company in our sample to do so. While nearly doubling its labor productivity, PCC managed to reduce its overhead ratio by 3 percentage points. It lifted its gross profit-to-sales ratio from 27 to 35%. The combination of a positive industry trend and successful execution of multiple moves makes PCC a showcase of a high-odds strategy, and perhaps highlights why Berkshire Hathaway agreed in 2015 to buy PCC for $37.2 billion. And, as Exhibit 18 shows, the rewards for shareholders were obvious. By contrast, if you remember the other two companies we discussed, Dai Nippon Printing and United Natural Foods, UNFI, both faced industry and geographic headwinds and were not able to do enough to overcome them. Exhibit 19. DNP began with a reasonable endowment, but only successfully made 2 of the 5 possible moves, so our model predicted a 69% likelihood of its sliding to the bottom quintile, and so it did. UNFI only cleared the threshold on one attribute, but improved productivity enough in an industry where productivity matters a great deal that our model gave it high odds of staying in the middle ranks. That's also exactly what happened. To be clear, PCC has been a great performer over that 10-year period, but we are not touting PCC as a great case example. There is no predictive power in this analysis for PCC's performance looking forward beyond 2015. We are simply explaining its success over the previous 10 years and use the example to demonstrate that this success would have been predictable had we known their strategy and the aerospace industry trend in 2001 to 2004. Know the odds. In analyzing the odds of moving on the power curve across 2,393 of the largest companies in the world, we found that endowment determines about 30%, trends determine about 25%, and your moves determine about 45% of the probability of moving on the curve. While the industry trend is the single most important lever among the 10, it is strategic moves that, in aggregate, explain almost half of the mobility of companies on the power curve. Electrical equipment maker ABB and chemicals giant BASF are examples of companies with strong endowments that leveraged those advantages to move from the middle quintile on the power curve to the top quintile over the decade that our research covered. In terms of trends, Japanese automaker Isuzu was helped by strong industry and geographic tailwinds to move all the way from the bottom quintile of the power curve to the top. In terms of moves, we've seen how PCC pulled 4 of the 5 levers and moved to the top. While we've treated each lever separately, in reality these attributes work in concert. The odds aren't calculated by simple addition, but by careful accounting of combined influences that have been identified in our research analyses. The actions on the 10 levers typically have to be much bigger than you'd think, and what matters is whether they